All right. Thank you. This is Julie Fedorchak with the North Dakota Public Service Commission. It's 11 o'clock, and we are gathered in the commission hearing room for a presentation from Technostrobe on light intensity dimming systems. We call them LIDS around here. So we're excited to hear this information. I believe we have Jeff Grabner. Jeff, are with Technostrobe, and you're planning to make a presentation to us this morning. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am, that is correct.
All right, very good. Welcome. In the room with us, we have both the other commissioners, Randy Christman and Brian Crosius, and we have our staff, Brian Johnson, and a couple other IT and other staff as well. So, Randy or Brian, do you guys have any opening comments?
No opening comments for me.
I do not, thank you.
All right, very good. So, without any additional opening comments, I mean, Jeff, you've probably heard some of our discussion about this technology in the past. It's certainly kind of front and center in North Dakota as we grapple with how best to implement the light mitigation systems and use them to decrease impacts of wind development in our state. And so thank you for offering to give us an update on your solution. And I'm going to turn it over to you or Brian. Do you have any opening remarks you'd like to make, Brian?
I don't.
Okay. So, Jeff, the floor is yours. Please go ahead and get started, and we'll probably just all interrupt with questions as they come up and as you talk.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much, Commissioner, for the introduction as well as the invitation for today. I know I did participate in the listening in for the December 11th hearing on ADLS solutions, which is, I think, sparked a direct follow-up, hoping to speak with you. So here we are today, so a very fortuitous stage. And again, thank you. Is there an opportunity to go ahead and share my screen?
I believe there is, yes. Our tech guide.
Hey, I just made you the presenter.
There we go. Sorry, I popped up on a different window. Okay, wonderful. Everybody, are we good? We have visual contact?
We do, yes.
Excellent. Well, thank you again all very much today for your time. Our goal is to have an open dialogue and a progressive conversation on our light intensity dimming solution technology, which, as you mentioned, LIDS is how we go by it. And yes, very informal presentation, so as questions arise, please do not hesitate to interrupt. So for today's purposes, based on conversations with Brian, we will walk the commission through the standards set forth by the FAA on beacon intensity and acquisition distance, how our LIDS technology functions as a source of light mitigation, and finally, where we stand on our approval with the FAA today. So these are the points we would like to cover, and I would just like to make sure I validate these are the points that you want us to cover in today's discussion. Is that correct?
Looks very good. Anything to add?
Excellent.
Number three is clever.
Learn that one at a young age. 1 + 1 = 3. So why do we need lights on our wind turbines? Well, wind turbines are a potential obstacle for aircraft. They must therefore be lit as per the FAA standard AC70/7460-1M, most recently updated in November of 2020. Recognizing that such lights can be perceived by the local communities as a nuisance, much work has been done over the past years to mitigate the impact of these lights, starting with two major initiatives. First, the tightening of the beam to avoid the problem associated with what we call ground scatter. The original incandescent bulbs had a 20-degree beam that could be seen, and the LED lights have now tightened it down to a 3-degree beam, +1.5, -1.5. And the xenon rough sat there in the middle, roughly at 5 to 6 degrees. That's the first point. The second point is all lights on a wind farm must be synced. and that changed the standard somewhere in the early to mid 2000s. With the tightness of the beam, the homes closer to the turbines are less affected. So as you can see on your screen here, this image shows the topography changes. And as a home gets closer in the altitude with the center of the beam, the flash appears more intense. So again, that's been the benefit through the LED technology. But once you are 2,000 meters out or beyond, again, you're in that visual sight of the beam, which makes it more of a, quote, nuisance. So our lids, let's get into this in terms of how does it work. And I, again, thank you for the opportunity to share this. Well, first and foremost, the problem is not the plane. The problem is the lights. And we are folks that are optical and we think optically. So lighting is designed to provide a pilot with the necessary signal to avoid the obstacle safely. When a pilot navigates in the worst visibility conditions allowed under VFR, visual flight recognition conditions, 2,000 candela is required. But most of the time, visibility conditions are great. So at 10 kilometers or more, driving the lights at 2,000 candelas at night is therefore overkill. Today, there are two forms of light mitigation, which are very specific and sensitive to House Bill 1378. One is radar, or also known as ADLS, Aircraft Detection Lighting System. And the other is our technology, LIDS, Light Intensity Dimming Solution. Any questions thus far?
So far, so good.
Perfect. So how does it work? Well, the goal is to ensure safe turning distance in worst visibility conditions when pilots are flying. So to accomplish this, we must calculate the intensity the pilot needs in all flying conditions. So on this slide here, we show the basic math. So in your bottom right, you can see that a turn must be initiated at 1.3 kilometers out to avoid an obstruction. And that signal must be received by an aircraft at 1.9 kilometers to safely avoid the obstacle, again, as mandated by the FAA, as well as Transport Canada. Well, as visibility conditions increase, we can decrease the intensity of the beacon and still provide pilots with the necessary acquisition distance. So our solution maintains a safe acquisition distance for pilots while greatly reducing the intrusiveness of the light to the surrounding community. The community never notices the intensity changes since the light's intensity increases only as the visibility decreases. Imagine that one of those wonderful northeastern or polar vortex storms. Lights are at full intensity. Having that is not so much of an issue for all the residents and communities. Well, the challenge is how bright should the light be?
Jeff?
Yes, sir.
I don't know how much to focus on making some notes of this as opposed to just listening and taking it in. So is the information, the screenshots, is that something you can send us that we can have?
Yes, I can send you the presentation after our meeting.
Okay, thank you.
So the challenge is, how bright should the light be so the pilot gets the signal he or she needs in varying visibility conditions without overkill? On June 1st of last year, Transport Canada, which is the equivalent to the FAA north of the border, approved our LIDS technology for deployment on wind farms. And as you can see here, we have our recommendation, but also approved by Transport Canada, those intensity levels. So when the visibility is at 1.6 kilometers or less, we recommend keeping it to the standard of today's 2,000 candela intensity. When it's 5 kilometers or greater, we recommend it going to 30% intensity. And when the visibility is 10 kilometers or greater, we would suggest reducing it down to 10% or 200 candela. Of course, behind all of this, there's definitely science. Well, how is the science there and what is that science? We have adapted what we call the forward scatter principle, which is essentially measuring particle density in the air. The equipment allows us to make a visible reading at point A and extrapolate as to the visibility at point B, which is 5 kilometers out, and point C, 10 kilometers out. The sensor that goes on top of the tower, which are not on every turbine, but I'll show you later on in terms of which turbines do get those and why. The sensor is robust. It stable, heated, and almost maintenance-free. In our case, we recommend and work with our customers to clean those lenses every 6 months with a microfiber cloth. That's to the extent of O&M on there. Again, it's not reinventing the wheel. The FAA currently allows this technology to establish runway visual range, or RVR. And when you are using this on a wind farm, our accuracy between the 600 to 1500 meters is at 90%.
Jeff, just a point of clarification. So you guys construct sensors at 5K and 10K out? Is that correct? Is that what I'm to understand?
No, ma'am. When we have a wind farm, and a wind farm is identified as one obstruction by the FAA, whether it's one turbine or 100 turbines. Within that, every turbine within a half statute mile radius needs to have a beacon, so 1 mile in diameter. And for our LIDS technology, we put a sensor atop a turbine every 1.5 kilometer radius or a 3 kilometer diameter. So we'll put this up on a, and I'll show you on a slide there, it has a sample farm, but not every turbine will have one of these sensors. That answers
so
the question.
So how do you determine the visibility? How do you determine the visibility at the various distances, 1.6, 5K, and 10K?
That is through a lot of the science and algorithms we have running in the background. So when these sensors are on top of a turbine, they're all measuring the particle density in the air simultaneously. Mm. That goes down tower, goes back into the O&M building, typically where we will have server as well as system. It's constantly running data and algorithms in terms of predicting visibility 1, 5, and 10 kilometers out from the farm. So there's not physical equipment beyond the perimeter of the farm itself. We are simply running an analysis, a predictive analysis of what that visibility is based on the particle density in the air.
I see. Okay, thank you. Brian has a question.
The 90% accuracy jumps off the page for me. Can you explain that a little more? Is that in terms of detecting an approaching aircraft, or am I looking at something else? Or does it represent something else?
I will have Francis chime in on the 90%, but I can tell you that our technology is completely autonomous from radar, from aircraft. It does not affect by aircraft at all.
Right, Jeff, if I can jump in very quickly, that this technology actually has nothing to do with trying to detect the plane. The accuracy rating has to do with the ability of the equipment to accurately predict what the actual visibility will be at 5K and at 10K. It's an accuracy reading. So in regards to that power of prediction. And as Jeff mentioned, the reason we have multiple points of measurement on the wind farm is that fog can move at different speeds and at in different ways on very large wind farms. What the FAA and Transport Canada insisted is that we have a condition called worst case winds. So if we see the visibility decreasing at one end of the wind farm, then the entire lights on the wind farm must operate as a single unit and dim down and dim back up according to that condition, worst case winds.
Very good. And who was it that was just speaking? I'm sorry, I didn't catch.
This is, my name is Francis Lacombe. I'm the I'm the vice president at Technistrobe, and I was part of that original team 6 years ago that had this bright idea to try to come up with another way to mitigate the lights on wind farms. So I've seen both the technology grow up, and I've contributed to the efforts to try to convince lawmakers and regulatory bodies to adopt this new technology. I'm actually right now physically in Lille. It's a city in the north of France. I travel between North America and Europe regularly.
Well, lucky you. Francis.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I believe...
drinking better coffee than I am, I'm quite sure of that.
I believe this is our first witness to testify from France, for one thing. Since Francis said that it was a bright idea, I'm wondering, is it always a bright idea, or are there times when it's dim?
It's a good point, actually. We're trying to make the ambiance a little bit more agreeable. So, and by the way, this is a Canadian idea. So the head office of TechGrobe is based just on the outskirts of Montreal. So it's people from the north, just like yourselves, that have came up with this idea.
You can use that joke for free in the future.
With pleasure.
All right, thank you. Did they get your question answered, Brian? Did you have follow-up?
Yes. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure that I was interpreting, you know, what it did correctly versus getting tripped up on something else. So now that explains it. Thanks.
Absolutely. Well, and here I want to show a demonstration of a farm that is currently actually operating in your neck of the woods, the Rugby Wind Farm, that is seeking to be compliant for House Bill 1378. It consists of 52 towers, which are identified by the green dots. Of that, based on the FAA guidelines, 41 of those towers will have beacons, which you can see through the red circles being every half statute mile radius or 1 mile diameter. And the larger yellow circles are our lid sensors. So 11 sensors will be placed on this farm to reiterate the point Francis mentioned earlier, which is our accuracy and our redundancy in terms of readings.
And the sensors go on one tower within that radius, or where do they go again?
So each of the yellow circles in towards the center will have a turbine there. So for instance, the very top left yellow circle, that one sensor will cover an area of 6 turbines themselves.
I see. Okay.
So in God we trust, all of us bring data. It always sounds good, but what is it in reality? And that's why I want to share with you the data we have on a wind farm that is in Quebec City, which is the Mont Saint-Gormand wind farm. 143 megawatt capacity, 3.2 megawatt turbines, with a total count of 46 turbines out there. And this was a particularly challenging farm during the development phase. Reason being, there's a very large astronomy club, both amateur and professional, in the Quebec City area. And so when you challenge their dark skies on clear nights, they were quite pushback, a lot of pushback in terms of putting up 46 red blinking lights throughout the night. So we worked with the local community as well as the developer to share our technology and also prove and educate through our technology. This would be a viable solution for both parties. And so from January through the end of October of last year, 66% of the time, the beacons are at 10% intensity. More than 2/3 of the time. So again, the lights are always on. We're just simply increasing or decreasing the level of intensity.
And what?
Which again gives that acceptance.
Account the only 2% at the 30%. So it's either on or they're on 100% or they're 10%. It seems like that middle range is rarely used. Is that just the weather conditions there, or?
Yes, ma'am. That would be the weather conditions. We have oftentimes, if a farm is looking at our technology as a possible solution, we can actually go through and run a historical exercise. We can take a 30, 60, 90, 120 day time frame, and then we capture that sun up, sun down part of the day, and then we'll actually study all the weather patterns and visibility, because that isn't usually recorded in major metropolis areas. And then we can actually show through data in terms of what that farm would be in terms of intensity levels. And often this is kind of where you see at least 50% of the time they'll be at 10% intensity. But again, back to your question, yes, each geographic region is different.
Okay, very good.
If I can,
yes, sir.
Uh, I'm sorry if I can be permitted just to say a little something about that. The idea here is that when we talk to developers on how this technology performs and the kinds of promise that they're making to the local community, the point we're making here is that they are not overpromising. They are not stating that the lights will be off. They are actually saying that the lights will be on, but that eventually you'll forget about them because of this dynamic nature of the dimming. On clear nights, you'll see them a little bit, and then on nights where it's very foggy and they're operating at full strength, you're still not really going to see them because it's foggy out there and the visibility is impacted. So the idea here is not to set expectations that are beyond what is reasonable to attain.
Go ahead, Randy.
In this case, if we simplify it down, that about two-thirds of the time they're at 10% and a third at 100%, is the finding that most nights it goes all night at 2%, and then on when you get into a time where there's maybe a few nights of lesser visibility, then those nights they're on at 100%? Or is this something that kind of bounces back and forth between the hours of the night?
So the idea here is that we're measuring the intensity of the light on the in the entire night. So this is hours of illumination. So what this screen shows is that 66% of the time the lights are operating at 10%, and then 32% of the time they're operating at, I think Jeff was saying that this is a 30% rating. So what it means is that this area has a tendency to see some fog. So it has to do with the dynamic nature of the system. If a fog bank comes in for an hour and a half, then the lights are going to increase in intensity. And as the fog leaves the area, then they dim down again.
One more follow-up on that. When they're running, operating at 10% intensity, how do you have figures as to how far away you can see them, how far away they are visible?
Yes, that is the purple cow, the holy grail of this. There are mathematical models that indicate, and Jeff actually has been working with one of the developers on estimating what that will actually be. But what we're seeing is that on the outer edges, so at 5 kilometers and 10 kilometers away from the farm, there is very little light that is still being seen. Because remember, we're not trying to illuminate anything here. We're simply trying to catch a pilot's attention to the existence of that obstacle in the area that he or she will be traveling in. So we can provide some estimates in terms of what that distance will be.
Madam Chair?
Did you have them now, or is that site-specific? Sorry, Brian.
No, it's okay.
That's not site specific. It has to do with the science of lighting, and that's just. It, I don't have the data in front of me now, but that's something that we can send you along with the deck that Jeff has prepared.
Sure. Okay. Because I feel like somebody mentioned it to us once, and but I don't recall what the distance was. But it was shockingly short. In my opinion. So I'd like to know if I'm remembering that correctly or what that is. So thank you. Brian has a question.
I do. Can you reiterate on this particular, these statistics, if this is a far removed facility? And here's what I'm thinking. If a facility, for example, is in proximity to a larger metropolitan area with a larger population, more planes going in and out of their airports, particularly private planes. So just to reiterate whether or not this is a removed facility from that type of a situation or if this is an average, because I can see situations where even though they have to be so far from flight patterns, et cetera, these things could be going off all the time if it's not that far from a busy airport, if you will.
I think the point that you're raising is very good. But I just want to reiterate the fact that this technology is not at all triggered by planes. The passage of planes has no impact on the dimming process of the lights. The lights go up and down strictly associated with visibility levels. Okay, this farm is actually not that far away from the urban center of Quebec City, so it would be an hour and a half to 2 hour flight, if you wish, from that site. So there are a number of planes that are flying in that area, but the lights are not activated by the passage of a plane. They are only moving up and down in intensity levels according to the visibility.
Right, and I think to second on your comment there, Francis, that also means that there is no other interference or false positive, such as birds or tractors or combines that are, have other implications for other areas. So essentially, if you took this wind farm and put it in the center of North Dakota and you had these results here, 5 years later, there's an airport 5 miles down the road. Whether it's not changed, you'll have the same results.
And just to follow up, so I understand and can explain this to others, if policy folks who wonder, the whole point or theory of this is you just have the lights on based on the conditions. They're always on at some point. If it's foggy, they'll be bright. If it's not foggy, they'll be less. And that's just the status of the lights, regardless of what's happening around them. It's all based on the conditions, the visibility conditions, how bright the lights will be. So regardless if there's a plane or not, they would be able to see it.
That is exactly the case. And just so you know, to go a little further in regards to that point, the reason that the lights are currently flashing at 2,000 candela is that this approach to measure visibility in a dynamic way has never been conceived. The regulators, they said, well, what are the worst visibility in which a pilot can fly? And then they said, well, how bright must the light be for the pilot to see the light in those conditions? So they said, it's 2,000 candela in the worst conditions. Let the light flash at that brightness all the time. This technology, this approach is new. It says, well, because we can measure the visibility, let's dim it. Let's not give the pilot overkill when the pilot has great visibility for flight. I'm not sure if I was clear on
that. Makes sense.
Okay.
Correct. And I think to further compliment that, Francis, a lot of the science and the intensity levels we have put forth behind our product mimics and answers the requirements that the FAA has put out in terms of visibility acquisition distance.
So your earlier in your presentation, you said something that I thought kind of made a bunch of sense, and that is the plane is not the problem. The other technology, the plane is the problem. The plane triggers the lights to go on, or in this situation, you basically are saying these towers are the problem. They need to be lit appropriately so that the planes can see them. So let's make sure that no matter what the conditions, the lights are on appropriately, but as little as possible so they're not a nuisance to the public around.
That is exactly it. So provide the pilot with the necessary signal but don't disturb the neighbors with the light that's just on overkill.
Okay. Correct, right? You know, developers never get phone calls of too many planes flying over.
Yeah.
You get the phone calls from residents saying, turn off the red light. So, Mr. Fedorchuk, you're a great spokeswoman, so I thank you for that. It's a wonderful synopsis.
Okay.
So the next part of this is, where are we with the FAA approval? Because as House Bill 1378 states that wind farms must meet the requirements of light mitigation. And again, as mentioned earlier, there's one form of light mitigation approved by the FAA as of today. So not only with yourself and the commission today, we also have a lot of owners, operators, and developers that are very anxious to see this technology move forward, as it gives them another option, whether it's within your state grounds or with other states around the country. So in 2016, we began our initial testing, which was sent over to a farm in Oklahoma, part of an EDF area. And in 2017, as we just covered, was the launch of the Mont Saint Marie farm in Quebec City. As we started gaining traction, not only with attention and inquiries, but also progression with elected officials and governing bodies, we started a conversation with the 20th Air Force Base early last year, specifically Captain Gordon Blair and Lieutenant Michael Toomer, who had, I think they interjected one of your meetings at some point about the concerns of other light mitigation technologies. So mm-hmm. we continue to have a very open dialogue with them that's both supportive as well as vocally, and they would love to have our technology deployed from a safety as well as operational perspectives. Since then, last year, as well in February, we did complete the visibility flight tests with the FAA, which is the Cape May Airport, New Jersey. And then early July of last year, we completed the testing at the Photometric Laboratory at the Reynolds Center Polytechnic Institute, which is a 2-month, 24/7 testing process overseen by the FAA as well, which was a successful operation. And Francis, I'll turn it over to you for the updates as of last week from the FAA.
Yes. So obviously, just like yourselves, we are somewhat frustrated at the speed at which this new technology is being analyzed and tested for approval with the FAA. So it's a challenge. This is not necessarily top of mind with the research team at the FAA. So they have to deal with multiple priorities that are sometimes changing. So we encourage them, we support them, we try to move it along, but it's not necessarily an easy thing. So many follow-ups were done last fall following the successful confirmation from the photometric laboratory of what the FAA was actually seeing at its facility. And last week they came back to us and said that they needed to have additional FAA pilots fly over the New Jersey site where our lights are installed, so that we've got corroboration from more than two pilots, because right now, although a team of pilots has actually witnessed the site in Oklahoma, only two FAA specialists have actually flown over the site. So they need to have buy-in from other colleagues, because it seems that two isn't the magic number. So we asked them, is it 20? Is it 40? It seems to be more than three and less than six. So that was the magic number of eyes on site that need to witness the performance of the system. The challenge is that they told us that the all FAA test pilots are on lockdown because of COVID. So although they would have liked to have kept up the testing over the fall, no one has been able to fly at the New Jersey facility for this purpose. So that's one. The second point that was important is that from a priorities point of view, they clearly said to us that the people in Washington have asked them to invest most of their time on testing drones. so no one's flying in drones, but it seems to be a policy issue that is front and center with many of the colleagues in Washington, so that much of their focus is directed at that, and therefore there's less time and less focus. So this is a human element. Priorities get changed in regards to who's voicing the importance of the priority. So I don't think that this is necessarily a major stumbling block, but if someone were to put a bug in someone's ear and say, well, maybe move from where it is to somewhere else, it may incite them to allocate the time and resources necessary to complete the process. Because the only thing that needs to get done, I'd say 90% of the work is done right now, is the final step will be the writing of the technical note that needs to accompany this the final stage of certification for this project. So that is the update the fresh update we obtained as of last Thursday from our friends at the FAA.
What was the piece you said about if someone were to urge them to move this from back to front or whatever? Could you repeat that?
Certainly. It seems clear that the priorities of the laboratory are not necessarily objective. It's people determine these priorities. So there's been a lot of work, a lot of effort and resources associated with new regulations in regards to flying drones, okay? And that's the feedback we're getting from them, is that all of their time is spent on that specific issue. So if someone from a political point of view were to put an idea in an FAA official's ear that says, well, listen, that's important, but this stuff here, which is trying to solve a community acceptance issue, and it's related to the lights, which is in the mandate of the FAA, if that can simply be pushed along, maybe that would urge them to change some of the priorities that they are currently juggling.
And your sense is this is a pretty, there's just a little bit of work left to finish this up. It's not a huge task.
That is correct.
So it's like 75% of the way there or complete?
I would say 85% of the way there.
Okay.
Like I said, two steps. There needs to be some FAA pilots that corroborate what their colleagues saw during the flyovers last February. And then somebody's got to drill down on this technical note, which much of it already exists because of the amount of data that we've been able to share with the FAA.
Very good. And so your contact with the 20th Air Force base. So when we had an issue recently on a wind farm that the Minot Air Force Base basically said that they would not, well, I forget who said it. Maybe it was FAA. But anyway, the bottom line was the lights didn't work there. The ADLS didn't work there because it posed a risk, a security risk, to nearby missile launch sites. And so they didn't get FAA approval for the ADLS, and therefore they didn't get a permit from us. The LIDS technology wouldn't impact at all because the lights are running based on weather conditions, not the presence of or absence of aircraft in the area.
You are correct, Commissioner. I think you're specifically speaking possibly about Russo Wind Farm.
Yes.
Which was, yes, we Southern Power Company, which I think that's now transferred over to Elite. You are correct. So when we first reached out to the 20th Air Force Base, Captain Gordon Blair was our main point of contact because he was the one that physically attended your meeting. And after hosting our initial conversation or teeing it up with him, he also included Lieutenant Michael Toomer, as well as some members of their JAG team up there. And our objective in hosting a conversation with them is to further understand their concerns with ADLS on wind farms. And for them, there was two main points. One is safety. The 20th Air Force Base, which again manages our ICBMs, does a lot of flying of small fixed wing vehicle or helicopters, where the radar has a challenge of only picking up fixed wing aircraft. The second part was they do a lot of loitering as they're running both practice and routine missions. And once loitering, the aircraft will no longer pick you up because you're now part of that landscape. And then the third part was the vertical height changes and horizontal that they continue to do during the maneuvers and training can be confusing to the radar. So that was the safety side. The tactical side, as they put it, is if we are in a live mission situation, as you will, and they have deployed their helicopters to go to the launch silos, that the lights will be then triggering or alerting the enemy of the path of our troops going to site. So for them, we explained to them our technology that, one, the lights are always on. So for them, that was absolutely paramount. It's a safety thing. Whether they're loitering or they're moving around vertically or horizontally, they will always see the obstruction. The second part was it is not triggered by aircraft. It is based on weather. So you never, quote unquote, alert the enemy, or if it's a cloudy or foggy day, then their pilots also have a safe flight path as well. So they have been very supportive of our conversations. We've had several conversations with them since then. But safety and then tactical and operational are their main two points that they have given the thumbs up, as you will, for the LIDS technology.
Okay, very good.
Not to be dry-winded.
Yeah. Brian has another question.
Actually, I have two, and if you mentioned either of them, I apologize. What is the cost of LIDS? And I guess I'm not sure that I've heard figures for ADLS, but maybe they're synonymous between the two in terms of cost.
Sure. When you look at a wind farm, and we'll take that the farm we had on the screen earlier, which consisted of, I think it was 53 turbines. You know, regardless, you have to have the obstruction lighting per FAA requirements. So that will be a cost that whether you go one radar or LIDS, you must purchase. But when it comes to you're constructing a farm and you're deploying our equipment, rule of thumb is we're about a third of the cost of a radar system today.
Okay, so it's two parts. So this is probably going to be a dumb question, but I'm going to ask it anyway because I just want to make sure I've got this clear. So right now, I think because you don't have FAA approval, we're looking at ADLS for the wind facilities in North Dakota, and then this would be an add-on to the ADLS in terms of, so when the lights do come on, you know, once you get FAA approval, assuming you do, then they'll only come on, but at a much lower density level than they would have before. Am I looking at that correctly?
You are correct. Based on House Bill 1378, you know, states that FAA approved light mitigation technology can be deployed to your farms in the state or being compliant. When LIDS gets approved, it will fall under that light mitigation category. And then be as another option for developers and or the current owners and operators to have a light mitigation technology.
Yeah. If I can jump in, Jeff, if you don't mind, just to speak to the commissioner's question, it's a either or proposition. It is another solution. So I think you were referring to the fact that some of the developers were going to combine the technologies. There is no such discussion on the table right now to combine the technologies. It's either radar or LIDS.
Yeah, and that's why I asked about the cost factor, because ideally, when an aircraft is approaching a wind farm, for example, prior to it getting into range, that wind farm is dark, and it would be nice when the lights came on, it's a perfectly clear night, that they only came on at 10% versus 100%. And I realize that adds more cost, but that's why I was asking how much more cost if they're combined, and can they be combined from a technical standpoint? It just seems to be the ideal scenario from a visual standpoint.
Right. Remember the FAA is a risk averse organization. So they will always fail on the side of safety as opposed to boldly going where no one has gone before. So we believe that right now their interest is really in allowing for wind farm developers to have a choice, a basket of solutions. So in certain instances, a radar might be a better solution, and in other instances, a LIDS may be a better solution, depending on the proximity of local airports in terms of the change in visibility. So it's just it's another option in order to try to bring a greater level of community acceptance to the wind farm projects.
Okay, thank you.
Randy has a question.
Are you aware of any bulbs that are out there on wind farms, either something that was installed 10 or 20 years ago or something that's being marketed right now that with your system would be unable to be dimmed, that they have to be fully on or off?
That is correct. The ability to dim, so the ability of the beacon to dim, is a fairly new feature. So we're not the only game in town. There are other manufacturers that make a beacon that can dim, but it's a fairly recent technology. So yes, there might very well be beacons out there that are installed on farms that are 15 or 20 years old that do not have the ability to dim.
And would you think that that's an easy switch? Are the bulbs that are dimmable an expensive thing, or is that something that probably is not so much if one were investing in the rest of the technology to monitor the visibility conditions?
Right. So what we're seeing is that on some of those older farms, there's a lot more modernization going on than simply targeting the lights. Like, for example, it could be a complete repower project where the developer is going to change a number of components, the nacelle, the blades, even maybe the entire turbine. So in that instance, the modernization of the lighting equipment would simply be included as one more of the features involved in the repowering of the farm.
So just to follow up on Randy's question, when they implement LIDS, do they just replace the whole bulb system and use your bulbs and the sensors? Or can you use existing light that is on there, just replace the bulb and then add your sensors? I think that's kind of what Randy was getting at.
Okay, so I guess I'll give you an even more direct and simple answer. The answer is no. It cannot be as easy a retrofit as changing a bulb. The beacon itself has to change. There's a controller inside the nacelle that needs to change. And that controller does two things. It obviously drives the LEDs and therefore allows them to move up and down in terms of intensity levels. But there's also a component in there, which is an advanced communication component that allows the light to speak to the central processing unit. Remember, there's that condition we called worst case winds. So there's a central computer that attracts all of the signals from the visibility sensors, and then it must communicate to all of the lights on the wind farms the correct intensity. Once it's done that controller that I was speaking about confirms back to the central processing unit the actual intensity of the light. So there's they're just red lights, but there's a lot of technology behind them, and that allows them to perform like we want them and to be able to communicate intelligently like they need to do.
Got it. So you replace the whole lighting system with the LIDS system.
That is correct. Now, the price of the lighting systems has gone down incredibly over the last 20 years. So there is a delta associated with swapping out the old beacon with the new one, but that delta is much lower than it was in the past 5 or 7 years.
Okay. Any more questions?
Just to reemphasize, because Commissioner Fedorchak asked this earlier, and you said you'd provide something, but I hope we get some kind of a clear answer, and especially based on the facility at Quebec, it seems like it should be pretty easily provided. What is the expectation of the range that the lights are visible to people? If geography isn't an issue, when they're dimmed down, would you typically see them at 3 miles, 5 miles, or what?
Right. Those are calculations that we worked along with a customer of ours. And Jeff will hunt those down and hopefully get permission to be able to send you that information.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Brian, one more question?
Just a comment. And going back to the combination of the two systems, and I realize that it's an either-or proposition now, I would be highly supportive of that type of approach if it wasn't draconian in terms of cost. I realize there would have to be advancements in technology, but the public would be very supportive of getting the best of both worlds in terms of, okay, so the lights are coming on, they're triggered and approaching aircraft, but at a lower density. Something to certainly think about, and I realize that at this point in time it's, walk first, run later, but in a perfect world, I would love to see both.
All right. Well, Jeff and Francis, thanks for your time today. Appreciate the good explanation. Look forward to your follow-up information and the slideshow or the slide deck, which we'll also post online, because I know some folks that follow us are also following this and are eager to have access to your information as well. So with that, please let us know. You've got Brian Johnson's contact information. If there's new developments, if you haven't make any headway on the FAA approval, please do reach out directly to us, because we are really following this issue and working on it pretty constantly, especially right now in the throes of a legislative session. So it will be helpful to keep on top of it.
We'll definitely be sure to talk with Brian and the commission as well. And thank you for your time today. If I may propose one last question, is there a possibility or an appetite for the North Dakota PSC to inquire with either Senator Hoeven or Senator Kramer about, raising the flagpole a little bit in terms of contacting the FAA?
Right. Yes. That's where I was headed with that. And so I think in particular, Senator Hoeven's been pretty active in wind development for much of his public life, and it seems like something that he might be interested in and willing to do. So I thought I'd talk to my colleagues and see if anyone has any issues with that, but I think that makes some sense.
Yes, we'd be happy to draft a letter or cover letter for you on there, because I know specifically some of the recent endeavors both Kramer and Hoeven have done, reaching a compromise between, fossil fuels and renewables. So I think there is a middle ground.
Sure. Why don't you go ahead and send such a draft to Brian, and we'll take a look at it and proceed.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. All right. With that, I think this presentation and work session, whatever we're calling this, is it informal? And this informal is complete. Work session. Yeah, that's right, work session. All right, thanks again for your time.
Very good. It was a pleasure discussing this with you, all of you. Thank you.
Take care.